Coming to you from the West Coast, this is Politicos. Today is May 24th, 2018, and this is episode 87. This is your weekly politics recap with a West Coast perspective. If you haven't already, make sure to subscribe and leave us a review, like six more people did this last week, wherever you found us. Follow us on Facebook and Twitter, where we're at Politicos Pod, and support the show at patreon.com/politicos.
I'm Scott Dleinboom.
And I'm Ian Bushfield. On today's show, the Premier's pipeline meeting, which it wasn't supposed to be, and a look at how Scheer has done in his first year as leader of the Conservative Party. First, though, we have to thank our premier sponsors, Lindsay Tedds and Blake Hodson, for helping make the show possible. Politicos is in partnership with BC Today, British Columbia's brand new daily newsletter dedicated exclusively to BC politics. Sign up for a free trial to have unique coverage of the BC legislature delivered to your inbox every morning. Listeners, you get 25% off your subscription when you enter the offer code Politicos, all lowercase. For your free two-week trial of the newsletter, go to britishcolumbiatoday.ca. First up, apparently we can't actually walk and chew gum at the same time. This week, pipeline continued to dominate the news. There was supposed to be, and it ended up happening, this big Western Premier's Conference. I guess it wasn't big. People probably wouldn't have even known it happening until Rachel Notley decided she was boycotting it because, quote, it would be surreal and exceptionally tone-deaf for anyone to think we could politely discuss pharmacare and cannabis, the two major topics of this conference, when one of the players is hard at work trying to choke the economic lifeblood of the province and the country. So she ramped it up to 11 this week.
That she did. You know what? If you want to help the economic lifeblood of the country, maybe help and bring in this whole new industry from a newly legalized substance might help, you know, add a little juice to the economy.
Well, and Alberta has already brought forward and passed its cannabis regime. BC's done the same. Those are obviously still evolving, and that's why they need to talk more to each other, or else we're going to end up with the same weird and terrible liquor system we have. And we're getting there. But this idea that we can't talk about two issues at once is just so false. We do it all the time. Just look at the states. They're talking about six issues a day, and that's just how many new indictments there are against Trump and his team. So Rachel Notley didn't go to the conference. She sent Sarah Hoffman, her deputy premier, and one of the reports I read said that Hoffman effectively derailed the entire conference by continually bringing up the pipeline. The premiers were trying to co-author a letter to the federal government to talk about how they all had a united front on pharmacare, that we should start working towards an affordable plan, which is exciting news and something I'd love to talk more about, and a smarter approach to cannabis legalization. But Alberta was insistent that we put in there that we all agree that Trans Mountain Pipeline has to go forward. And for some reason, they couldn't get consensus on that. And so Alberta pulled its signature. This was followed up by another tweet from Rachel Notley with little graphic where she talked about how pharmacare doesn't grow on trees. I don't know anyone who was saying it did. Maybe some of the hippies who talk about like the natural drugs that you could just like smoke any plant you find and you'll be fine, but
yeah, some of the weed people, they probably think it grows on trees, but yeah, no one else does. And yeah, it's trying to tie everything back to this one issue and brings a little hollow, just oil is part of the economy, but it's certainly not the whole picture, not even the dominant part of the economy.
And that's the argument she's trying to make, is that without this pipeline, the oil industry is effectively non-existent or will cease to exist in Canada, and therefore we won't have any more money, and therefore we can't have pharmacare. And I'm happy she's talking about pharmacare in that sentence, but it's just, I don't know, disingenuous. It feels like she's trying too hard this week, maybe. We can say this. It got Rachel Notley and her position all over the news. The BC government was left playing defensive on the pipeline yet again, instead of, I don't know, talking about these other issues. Maybe it helped us bring pharmacare out because we wouldn't talk about it unless it's with pipelines, I guess.
It would have still been news if, you know, the Western provinces had gotten together and said this, especially because Scott Moe apparently signing on to this, which is interesting, because you wouldn't think either Saskatchewan or Manitoba's government would be super on board with the idea of a pharmacare program.
I don't know if it was a NDP dream pharmacare program. Again, all the details got buried by Alberta's pipeline talk. So I could see a conservative argument for better affordable drug program within the health system that we have. The other thing on the pipeline front is Alberta's Bill 12 that recently passed is the turn off the taps bill there. We don't want to give Alberta any gasoline while they're blocking the pipeline in whatever ways they're doing. David Eby went to Alberta, or more accurately, probably faxed a letter to the courts in Alberta to file suit seeking a declaration finding Bill 12 to be unconstitutional because we shouldn't be restricting trade between provinces.
BC's arguing that Bill 12 effectively violates the Constitution, both Article 91 and Section 121, which we talked about quite a bit in our Como discussion, so refer you back to those if you're interested in diving into details of that. And effectively saying that no, Alberta can't just unilaterally decide that one province isn't going to get any of its exports of a particular good.
And it gets tougher than this because it goes into detail on how BC considers this bill to be beyond the powers that Alberta has under Section 92A of the Constitution. And there's a schedule, and this section talks about what things provinces can do in terms of exports. And there's a schedule to this that defines the specific exports. And under that sub-schedule, it explicitly says that the products that they regulate cannot be resulting from refining crude oil, refining upgraded heavy crude oil. So if Alberta wants to stop raw bitumen from coming to us, that's a different issue. But when they want to turn off the literal gasoline that we will use to fuel our cars,
a good chunk of the interior, for example, gets their fuel refined in Alberta. So that would, yeah, cause some problems there for sure.
The rest of the initial petition is spent arguing that the act is intended to punish British Columbia. So it's a he said, she said type thing, referring to all the statements of Rachel Notley of, I am literally going to pass a bill to turn the taps off. And these are the kind of things you say, look, they're not doing this to just regulate trade. They're doing this out of spite. And it shows the intention of the bill wasn't a regulatory thing, but an actual attempt to infringe upon interprovincial trade. And I've seen a couple legal opinions look at this and say, BC's actually got a pretty good case here. Now, if it turns around, and everyone's already pointed out the irony of BC arguing the opposite when it comes to the oil coming in.
It's a little nuance there.
It is nuance because they focus on the environmental side rather than just the
trade. You can differentiate the two cases. I mean, it's still this weird situation where both provinces are simultaneously arguing that oil can and cannot be exported through another province. So it's at a super high level, yeah, that's kind of a weird position, but in terms of the nitty-gritty legal arguments, they are, in fact, different. So you could have two tort cases come out two different ways.
I've never actually read through a petition like this, but I do like that it starts notice to defendant, you are being sued, you are a defendant. That's like the most straightforward legalese I've ever seen. It's very to the point. I always assume they were much, you know, denser than that.
Would there be a little more Latin in the front?
Or just, you know, like the respondent, defendant, judicial center, and then just like statement of facts and things like that. But no, this is just, you're being sued. Go to the end to find out what to do. And it gives Alberta 20 days to file its initial response. And so we should expect to see that soon. Of course, then we also have to hear if Canada wants to intervene, if Saskatchewan apparently wants to intervene as well.
They will, just because Saskatchewan wants to intervene in all of these, just because.
And then a court date could be months away to a year away, and we're not going to hit that May 31st deadline. That is coming up next week.
Yeah, although this Bill 12 isn't really there to kind of get that May 31st deadline so much as apply a little pressure on BC. Wouldn't surprise me if BC tries to just get a injunction early, gets this going into effect, and we might see the initial stages before the full legal battle goes through.
Well, and that's part of it, because this is just looking for a declaration that the law is unconstitutional. Alberta can still go ahead and try to apply the law and turn off the taps until BC files for an injunction and says they can't do anything until this court battle sorted out. So there's still some timing issues, but you know, this is, Alberta said we were going to pass this, and BC said we're going to sue you if you pass it, and everyone is playing the parts they've said they will play. But in other legal news, BC court dropped two rulings today in moves that both the City of Vancouver and the Squamish First Nation had filed against the Trans Mountain Pipeline. Both were raising questions around the National Energy Board's approval of the pipeline and whether the province could make some moves around that. And in both cases, the court said, no, go away, these lawsuits don't follow. What was interesting, because the court, it was noted, took exceptional lengths to say all the things this didn't answer, which is, this has nothing to do with the national interest questions. This had nothing to do with the environment. This has nothing to do with consultations. This is just about like a specific legal question. And even still, Vancouver's considering maybe appealing this. The Squamish Nation's disappointed, but might go ahead. And Vancouver has also been slapped with the costs for Kinder Morgan. And I think that was listed as something like the 16th victory in a row for Kinder Morgan. They've managed to win most of the cases so far. And I don't know that that's as easily read as they will win them all, because it's easy to win a lot of quick, dumb court challenges early because they're bad and should be thrown out. But if there's a clear case that they didn't consult properly or that it has environmental, that will take longer to sort out.
Yeah, and I think the one the municipalities are throwing, like Burnaby's tried how many suits now?
Well, they're trying another today too.
Yes, and those ones, very clearly, they don't have any jurisdiction over, and they keep getting slapped down on that. So those aren't surprising. I think I have a pretty good sense where they're entered out. The consultation issues get a little more fuzzy on what the likely outcomes are going to be there.
So we've had a lot of bluster this week. And as I mentioned, we have 7 days until Kinder Morgan's claim deadline. What do we expect to happen in this next week?
Somehow Rachel Notley will escalate the rhetoric even more.
More memes.
Yes. Jason Kenney will be unconvinced by this and claim she's not doing enough.
Are we going to see cash from Alberta or the federal government beyond the indemnity Trudeau has already put up, which is billions of dollars?
I don't think the federal government's going to chip in anything beyond that. Province of Alberta? I'd say there's a 30, 40% chance they might.
I guess it all is dependent on what's happening in the closed doors with Kinder Morgan. I wonder, thinking back to 2015 and when Alberta was in the midst of an election, how many people were like, oh, I sure hope by voting NDP that this government will in 2 or 3 years put money into a private oil company to get a pipeline built. It wasn't even on the election then. But here we are, such is politics. So I guess we'll find out next week if we can say definitively whether this pipeline is dead or not, but I feel like we're going to keep dragging this on.
Moving on to segment two, a Scheer year. Well, a couple days from now, it'll be 1 year since Andrew Scheer became leader of the Conservative Party. So we thought we'd kind of go and do a bit of a, well, what do they have to show for it? Retrospective. So mid last year, he barely won. Yeah, on the ranked ballot, he literally went to the final round and narrowly edged out Maxime Bernier. And I still have friends who are cursing the dairy farmers because of that result.
It took a while to get that final result out, and not as long as the Ontario PCs, which I think collapsed in on itself, trying to figure out how to not count Doug Ford in the lead. And that's become its own scandal. But over the next few days, there were kind of some outstanding questions about the ballots, but they kind of all came together pretty quickly, which I guess is good for a new leader, even when you only narrowly edge out someone who is ideologically different than you.
At least in the short term, there wasn't much animosity there. Things were pretty calm. Lately, Bernier's been made a little more noise about his intentions after Scheer inevitably ceases to be leader. But yeah, going off, he's starting a little bit of a weak position just because it was such a narrow ballot, but overall had the party behind him.
Yeah, and he spent the first little while in relative obscurity, and I think even recently is still struggling with that issue. He's, throughout the race, was who? that sort of other they also ran, but who just managed to piece together a coalition of existing members.
As you alluded to, that's largely because he didn't really try and reach outside the party base at all. When everyone else was busy outselling memberships, he was basically campaigning to the base, and that ended up paying off for him. But it did mean when he became leader, he was kind of a bit of a nobody. And even since then, he's struggled a bit to kind of get his name out, and not all of the attempts at doing so have gone particularly well. We made fun of his Hello Fellow Humans video that he put out a few months back.
That said, overall, between his slow and steady approach, maybe, and Trudeau and the Liberals somewhat shooting themselves in the foot every month or two, Scheer has managed to bring the Conservatives from roughly 29% in the polls up to 37%, and the Liberals have fallen from 42% to 36%. And there was a brief period in there where the Conservatives had a gap where they were in the lead. It's closed a little bit recently, but that's from Eric Grenier's poll tracker aggregator. So it's been an increase in support for the Conservatives, and whether that's attributable to Scheer's force of will or just the Liberals, India screw-ups, Bill Morneau's very poor rollout of small business income tax changes.
Pretty sure it's those. I don't think Scheer's really managed to connect with Canadians at all, and it's the little traction he has got's mostly been on those Liberal screw-ups. And the point where he actually briefly pulled ahead of the Liberals, it was during the whole India trip debacle and subsequent fallout. And that, I think, has been the issue here, is that, great, if the government is shooting themselves in the foot, yeah, Scheer can kind of pick up some of those people who aren't that happy with the Liberals anymore, but absent a government scandal or a massive bundling of a major policy rollout, like, where does he go and how does he build the brand or the party or gain more supporters?
And one of the things he's done on policy has not been much. So he spent a lot of time opposing, which, yeah, he's leader of the official opposition, that's your job. But his opposition has been, we think the carbon tax is a scam and a massive ripoff to all Canadians, and we would immediately repeal the mandatory nature of this, and we'd have our own climate change plan because we're not climate denialists anymore. But he won't tell us what that is, or even like allude to it. You know, it's still a while out till an election. We don't have to expect a full platform out from any of the opposition parties, but knowing what kind of approaches to climate change this Conservative Party would support would be valuable, I think.
Yeah, especially because it is a major weak spot of the Conservatives, and a lot of people see that the "are you going to do something about climate change" as kind of an entry-level pass-fail question to be considered to as someone to vote for, and there hasn't been a good answer out of the Conservatives on this at all.
Well, and the entire leadership debate was Michael Chong saying we should have a carbon tax. I think Deepak Oberai saying, yeah, probably.
Nuclear. Yeah.
Nuclear plants.
Yes. Yeah, build nuclear plants, including having a prop nuclear rod at one of the debates, which was great. I miss seeing Deepak out there.
Then the other candidates, basically, including Scheer, going hard nuclear against carbon taxes, just saying we should never have them, let the market somehow figure out climate change.
Or a sector-by-sector approach is something that sometimes gets thrown out, which is like the exact opposite of what the textbook center-right position should be on climate change.
And he's tried to say Trudeau hasn't done enough on the pipeline, but then he also got upset when public funds were put up there, so he's kind of boxed in there. And that's kind of what the Liberals have also been somewhat effective at over the last year, is bringing forward policies to try to box in Andrew Scheer and the Conservatives, really trying to say, are you social conservatives or not? And the Liberals, like we said, brought forward this weird gun bill, which on the whole was kind of like some good thing, some like, eh, but.
Yeah, and the same thing with the summer jobs grant. There wasn't really a reason to reignite the abortion debate that had been left dormant for quite a while in Canadian politics, but, you know, it got the Conservatives to look like a bunch of social conservative aggressives. So, you know, I guess points to Trudeau on that one, but like it wasn't a clear this is a policy thing that we really need to tackle.
Though there is a whole weird issue with the Canada Summer Jobs Grants, and I could go
you could reform the Summer Jobs Grant, but making it an abortion fight was a weird way to go about it if the actual point was to improve the Summer Jobs Grant rather than pick a fight that conservatives will lose.
And even there, the liberals kind of shot themselves in the foot because the way they rolled that requirement out as an attestation rather than, it was like, you must morally prove that you will not fund abortions rather than just say that's a requirement of the jobs program. It's like a test that you are pro-abortion. How about just not give money to religious groups? But Scheer sort of fell on, you know, screaming moral outrage over that. The thing he has managed to do, though, he's kept a lot of the social conservative wing down a bit. There have been a couple bozo eruptions, but some of the more radicals like Brad Trost and Kelly Leach, who both ran against him, lost nomination battles for their re-election bids, which for a sitting MP doesn't tend to happen unless the party doesn't care if you're gone, I find. That or if you're maybe just really bad at.
I don't think anyone likes Brad Trost.
His members did help Scheer win.
Yeah, you have a little bit of that, but I think they were mostly going there because he was the most socially conservative person on the ballot rather than we actually like Brad Trost the person. And from what I heard, he's not the easiest to work with. And like there was a reason he was basically one of the only people not to get a shadow cabinet position.
And he's still suing the party over the membership theft. But that's always fun.
Having Brad Trost leave federal politics is no great loss.
Well, and the other eruption he had in this past year was when Lynn Bayak was going on again and again about how great residential schools, and we should talk about that more. And Scheer finally managed to kick her out of caucus.
Weeks after should have happened.
And that's sort of the other floating issue around Scheer is his sort of connections with the modern alternative right edge. Early on, it was pointed out right after he won, because I guess no one thought to look in before, that his campaign manager was deep in rebel media. So he had connections with rebel media during his campaign, and they brought those people into his staff. And last summer, this little rally to unite the right happened in Charlottesville that blew up with the tiki torches, and rebel media correspondents were there saying Nazi things. And suddenly the conservatives got very distant very quickly from rebel media. And I think at that point, Scheer did say, I will never do another interview with them, and put his distance there. But that's kind of closed a little bit, I think. And I don't know if he's done a rebel media interview since. Rebel also did its own internal purge of the most extreme elements, but it's still not a bastion of like even moderate conservative thought. Andrew Coyne's not going to be writing there anytime soon.
I can't see that happening.
So he's still got that element within his party, and he's trying to figure out how to work with that, because the populist conservatism is a force in Canadian politics, as Doug Ford could probably tell us.
Although those ties aren't entirely gone. Hamish Marshall, he did get another job with the Conservatives after the rebel media connections came to light, and has in fact been named the 2019 campaign chair.
Great. So that's going to be something the Liberals will go to town on for. They're probably just waiting on that. But weird balances for Scheer. The other thing he started doing more recently is, in this last week especially, he was making a lot of efforts to reach out in Quebec. And it's a good time for politicians to be going to Quebec as the Bloc Québécois self-immolates as it implodes and forms two parties. There was a poll out by Léger recently that found the Bloc Québécois was at 12% in Quebec. And I remember when the Bloc was at 12% nationally because they were so dominant in Quebec. But essentially at this point, the Bloc will be wiped out. I can't imagine many of the splinter MPs in Quebec Debout will stand much of a chance. Maybe they are popular in their own ridings, but seeing this opportunity, Scheer's been spending time in Quebec. He signed up a major former separatist politician who disappeared from politics for a while and now has a conservative membership. And I think he's trying to play the Brian Mulroney, let's sweep Quebec, making lines like nationalism is a conservative position, you know, protecting culture, protecting heritage. trying to win over Quebec and build a new conservative coalition.
That's going to be a bit more of an uphill battle for Andrew Scheer, because unlike Brian Mulroney, who was an MP from Quebec, I have a sense that he's much more seen as that kind of Western conservative, and it's going to be a harder time convincing Quebec that he kind of gets them and shares their values to the same way that Mulroney was probably able to.
Or can even speak the language.
That too.
I think he's probably getting better, and he might even be doing... I haven't seen Scheer speak French recently, nor am I well-versed enough in the language to tell a great speaker from a good speaker. I can know a bad speaker, but he might be doing better than Harper was at the start of his term as leader, but that's not saying much. That said, the Conservatives and Liberals are tied in Quebec in the polls right now, with the Bloc so weak, and even the NDP is only at, I think, 14% there, so it's anyone's game which way they go. But where does Scheer go from here? He's got an election coming up, and it's his chance to become prime minister?
Probably not this election. As we were talking earlier, he only really seems to get any traction when the Liberals are hurting themselves by screwing something up, and the Liberal Party tends to run pretty slick campaigns. If they manage to maintain even a level of campaign performance that averages over the last, like, decade or two, like, it's going to be hard to lose that election for them, especially because you never see a first-term majority government completely lose an election in Canada. It's very rare, and I don't think Andrew Scheer has what it takes, absent a major Liberal scandal erupting, to actually come in and displace Justin Trudeau.
Then the question is, do the knives come out and the Conservatives turf him on an election loss?
Or I don't know if the Conservatives turf him. There will definitely be knives coming out from one Maxime Bernier.
The ones that are already being sharpened behind his back as he writes his book about how he should be leader.
Yes. Bernier is generally not a subtle person and has definitely not been subtle about where he thinks his future ought to be.
Well, and the other weird behind the scenes or slowly coming forward is Stephen Harper's comments in the last couple weeks, months of I could still pretty much be in charge if I wanted, which just feels like delusional at this point. Do what good former prime ministers do and just like disappear. He was doing that for a while. Every once in a while, Chrétien pops his head up or Paul Martin, but they generally don't comment on policy or the leadership of their party post hoc.
So, yeah, going forward, I just don't think Andrew Scheer's likely to become prime minister. I mean, crazier things have happened. Hell, I thought Andrew Horvath was going to be a write-off after completely lackluster...
Two
campaigns in a row. And it's now looked like there's a decent chance she's going to be the next Premier of Ontario. But that also did take some immolation on the other side of the aisle to get there. So, you never know.
Well, even if Scheer is able to hold Trudeau to a minority, it still seems difficult to imagine the NDP propping up a Scheer minority to
change
the tables. So, long road ahead for our boy from Saskatchewan.
Yeah, and I think the only question is, does he survive a leadership review after the next election? And if he doesn't significantly grow the party seat count, I can't see that happening.
Well, moving on to quick takes, we have a few more lawsuits to talk about because it's been a very litigious week. Let's start with one by a group called the Canadians Against the BC Speculation Tax. This group of poor, disenfranchised people from British Columbia who own 2-3 homes, or Albertans, or other people from across the country or around the world who just want the right to own a vacation home here in British Columbia, or something that they don't have to rent out, feel so hard done by that they have retained a lawyer who's written a letter, a strongly worded letter, to the Attorney General of BC, David Eby, arguing that this tax may violate their constitutional charter rights. They've started a GoFundMe as well, which is amazing, hoping to raise $300,000 to cover their legal fees. So far, they're at just shy of $23,000. Because they want to make this a giant class action lawsuit on behalf of everyone who is impacted by the BC NDP speculation tax.
I guess this was pretty much inevitable. but it strikes me as going to be a tough and uphill battle to convince a court that there is a charter violation happening here.
Yeah, property rights aren't a thing in Canada. Like, the government can't just take your stuff, but they can tax you fine. And you don't have, like, some fundamental human right to own second and third homes by any stretch. The entire thing strikes me as a giant grift. Like, we feel so outraged about this that we're going to start a GoFundMe and maybe we'll use it to sue, maybe we'll just use it to lobby. And now they've raised $23,000 to, which is not enough to file a class action lawsuit. Like, you could get started with that, but you're going to burn through that money pretty quick, making constitutional arguments that the BC government's going to fight you to death on and probably do a good job winning. And the lawyer they hired is not cheap. And it's actually interesting because they did hire someone who's relatively prominent. I believe he's a QC, but it's still such an uphill battle.
Yeah, like the only way I could kind of see even a hint of a road to success would be on the, oh, we're penalizing Albertans here, but since it also impacts British Columbians, like there's just nothing to go on there. And if they exempted people who reside in the province, like you could maybe kind of squint and look at it and see a way for it to
pass. It does charge them a different rate.
Yeah,
but
it's just a tough argument to make, and I can't see it having any.
Like, we also success. Don't let people who don't live in the province vote here.
Yeah, and so PEI has more restrictive rules around property ownership for people who don't reside there than we do. And
yeah, but property in PEI is cheap. So if you had to pay a little tax or something.
I think it's more restrictive than that. But, you know, that hasn't gotten overturned by the courts yet. So it's just strikes me as a way to waste a whole bunch of money.
Which they could just spend on the damn tax. Friggin' rich people.
Well, moving on to another lawsuit the BC government is involved with, this time on the other end of things, David Eby's announced they're going to consider suing manufacturers of opioids.
So this is part of something that's much bigger, and right now there's something like 22 states that are in active litigation against Purdue Pharma and a couple other cases, a couple other pharma companies, and three other states that are considering filing suit. So half the U.S. is suing pharma companies over essentially over-prescribing, over-pushing opioids and not fully disclosing the risks. This is because we are in the midst of this overdose crisis, a part of which is the over-prescription of pain medications that people, you know, middle class, upper class, everyone are getting addicted to, and their lives are falling apart over it. And the states and now BC are looking and going, did the pharma companies do anything wrong in this? And it'll be interesting to see if they go ahead with this suit. There's been a lot of calls for Canadian governments to take steps to push for criminal investigations into this. And this doesn't bring back lives that were lost, but it does maybe try to bring some accountability to what seems like it's been out of control for a while. So we'll keep an eye on it because pharma companies have been somewhat evil for a while, and maybe it'd be nice if the BC government could get some money to fund healthcare out of that.
We'll also be following it too, because the opioid crisis is just a huge thing that just hasn't gotten enough attention as well with some of the other stuff that's kind of focused provincial attention elsewhere. And yeah, where this goes is definitely going to be interesting.
Well, and finally, there was a bit of a kerfuffle between the Minister of Transport, Claire Trevanna, and BC Ferries this last week. The BC NDP, one of their big pitches was to try to freeze rising ferry rates and work to reduce them. Now, ferries run on gas and diesel fuel, which if you drive a car or pass any gas station recently, you'll notice that that's gotten really expensive. And that means driving your ferries back and forth costs more.
Yeah, and back when oil prices collapsed and fuel got a whole lot cheaper, BC Ferries had said, yeah, I mean, we raised our ferry fares in the past because we needed money to pay for fuel. And well, now that fuel's less expensive, we're going to rebate some of that back to everyone. And well, now the market's going the other way and they need that money now to keep the ferries running, offset those fuel costs. And they want to say, yeah, maybe it's time to roll back that rebate.
So they've been discussing this with the minister for a few weeks or months. And finally, BC Ferries announces, we are going to end this rebate effective almost immediately. And the minister blows her lid. She goes, I'm extremely disappointed with this. I'm surprised that they've done this. And BC Ferries goes, no, we've been talking about this for months with you. You shouldn't be surprised.
Plus, like, anyone who was paying attention when the rebate was brought in should be aware this was a likely outcome.
But the NDP have been talking about the need to not have ferry fares go up. It is a private corporation of sorts that...
heavily regulated by the province.
Yeah, and is trying to make money. But it's also a vital feature of our infrastructure system because many people can't get around without it on a regular basis. You
know, I grew up on the island. Like, bitching about the ferries is one of the pastimes there, and the fares are definitely part of it. At the same time, the full outrage on the part of the NDP is a little thin and tiresome.
But it worked because BC Ferries went back on their plans and canceled their planned end of the rebates. So after all was said and done, the ferry fares aren't going to change price. And BC Ferries is just going to operate at a bigger loss. There's still ongoing discussions about how to make the system more affordable and bring those fares down. It's one of those affordability pledges that the NDP essentially got elected on. So if they can't figure this out, they're risking, well, I guess they're risking votes in coastal ridings that they have a pretty good lock on. But you still don't want to piss people off on such a literal pocketbook issue.
I'm British Columbia, Victoria's my capital, Canada's westmost province, touching the Pacific coast. And I have lots of mountain ranges, Whistler Mountain is my most famous. If you're looking to ski or snowboard, I have lots of these places.
Well, moving into Best of BC Poly this week, at Vaughn Palmer, the Vancouver Sun journalist, tweets following a story he wrote about Notley merely an acquaintance of BC Premier Horgan, despite his assurance that they're friends, noting that she had described that they never were as friendly as he had said. He tweets, for perhaps the first time in Canadian history, one premier has unfriended another. And then I looked at the replies at this and I thought it was fellow veteran journalist Keith Baldry, but it was a parody account. And I wouldn't normally give a Best of BC Poly to a parody account, except I thought this one made me laugh, so it was good. Keith Bradley, at Keith Badley, I've been following this story for 20 years, and I think she should get on the plane and go with him. If not, she'll regret it. Maybe not today, maybe not tomorrow, but soon, and for the rest of her life. You can follow at Vaughn Palmer. I don't know if you need to follow parody accounts.
And also making the Best of BC Poly, past guest, Justin McRoy, put out a rather exhaustive rundown of where all the promises the BC government made during the election are and where they're at now. And we'll throw a link to that in the show notes. And he tweeted out, here's a link once more to the most exhaustive story I will probably do all year. In summary and conclusion, when he saw this list, at AJW Victoria BC, Andrew Weaver said I was a, quote, massive nerd.
The tweet's adorable, and just the fact Andrew Weaver, a professor of climate scientist and definite nerd, is calling Justin McElroy a massive nerd is also fantastic. But the article itself is really good. It's pure Justin McElroy of finding something to spreadsheet and doing a full, thorough accounting of it. But it's also something we almost did in prep for our recap a couple weeks ago with Jillian Stead, where we talked about the year since the BC election. Only we just looked at the confidence and supply agreement, but Justin did a thorough accounting. So it's actually impressive. The NDP has accomplished something like 60-odd% of their campaign goals and 75% are at least underway. A few have been abandoned, but that kind of makes you go, what are they going to do in the fall or next year or the following year if they're still government? And I guess this is the same issue Rachel Notley ended up in, and maybe you just end up in interprovincial trade battles.
And that has been Politicos. Finally, the stories we mentioned in the show notes at politicos.ca. Make sure to subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts. And follow us on Facebook and Twitter at Politicos Pod. Leave us a review and let us know what you think. Support the show and get early access to our interviews at patreon.com/politicos. And if you have ideas for the show, feel free to send them to us. Thanks for listening.